This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Welcome to the Poetry Corner of the Bookshelf.
And this is Michael Martin. I'm going to be helping bring you some poetry, not about children from an adult's remembrances, but poetry about children and to children as children. We're going to share some poems that I grew up with and then repeated to my children, and some other poems that were new to my generation. Welcome to the Poetry Corner.
And we're starting off with the music from one of my favorite Saturday morning shows when I was a kid, Big John and Sparky. The theme written by John Walter Bratton in 1907, The Teddy Bear's Picnic. One of the favorite beginnings for children's stories was the work of Theodore Geisel. Name not familiar? He was born in Massachusetts in 1904, attended Dartmouth College, and became editor-in-chief of the college humor magazine, The Dartmouth Jack-o'-Lantern. One evening during his senior year, he and nine of his friends were caught with a bottle of bootleg gin in his room. This was the days of Prohibition. As a part of his discipline, the dean ordered him to resign from participation in all extracurricular activities. Geisel's name disappeared from the pages of the College Humor magazine, but his illustrations did not. Unbeknownst to the administration, his work continued, but now under his middle name, Zeus. Upon graduation, he landed a job at Judge Magazine, and in 1927, his first professional work was printed with the addition of the name Doctor. And so, Dr. Zeus was born. Here follows The Lorax.
At the far end of town where the griggle grass grows and the wind smells slow and sour when it blows, and no birds ever sing, excepting old crows, is the street of the lifted Lorax. And deep in the griggle grass, some people say, if you look deep enough, you can still see today where the Lorax once stood, just as long as it could, for somebody lifted the Lorax away. What was the Lorax, and why was it there? And why was it lifted and taken somewhere from the far end of town where the griggle grass grows? The old Wunsler still lives here. Ask him. He knows. You won't see the Wunsler. Don't knock at his door. He stays in his lurkum on top of his store. He lurks in his lurkum, cold under the roof, where he makes his own clothes out of miff-muffered moof. And on special dank midnights in August, he peeks out of the shutters, and sometimes he speaks, and tells how the Lorax was lifted away. He'll tell you, perhaps, if you're willing to pay. On the end of a rope, he lets down a tin pail, and you have to toss in 15 cents and a nail, and the shell of a great-great-great-grandfather snail. Then he pulls up the pail, makes a most careful count to see if you paid him the proper amount. Then he hides what you paid him away in his snuff, his secret strange hole in his groovyless glove. Then he grunts, I will call you by whisper, my phone, for the secrets I tell are for your ears alone. Slup! Down slups the whisper, my phone, to your ear, and the old Wunsler's whispers are not very clear, since they have to come down through a snurgly hose, and he sounds as if he had smallish bees up his nose. Now I'll tell you, he says, with his teeth sounding gray, how the Lorax got lifted and taken away. It all started way back, such a long, long time back. Way back in the days when the grass was still green, and the pond was still wet, and the clouds were still clean, and the song of the Swami Swans rang out in space, one morning I came to this glorious place. And I first saw the trees, the truffula trees, the bright-colored tufts of the truffula trees, mile after mile in the fresh morning breeze. And under the trees I saw brown barbalutes, frisking about in their barbalute suits as they played in the shade and ate truffula fruits. From the ripulous pond came the comfortable sound of the humming fish humming while splashing around. But those trees, those trees, those truffula trees! All my life I'd been searching for trees such as these. The touch of their tufts was much softer than silk, and they had the sweet smell of fresh butterfly milk. I felt a great leaping of joy in my heart. I knew just what I'd do. I unloaded my cart. In no time at all, I had built a small shop. Then I chopped down a truffula tree with one chop, and with great skillful skill and great speedy speed, I took the soft tuft and I knitted a thneed. The instant I finished, I heard a guzzump. I looked. I saw something pop out of the stump of the tree I chopped down. It was sort of a man. Describe him, that's hard. I don't know if I can. He was shortish and oldish and brownish and mossy, and he spoke with a voice that was sharpish and bossy.
"Mister,"
he said with a sawdusty sneeze,
"I am the Lorax. I speak for the trees. I speak for the trees, for the trees have no tongues. And I'm asking you, sir, at the top of my lungs."
He was very upset as he shouted and puffed.
"What's that thing you have made out of my truffula tuft?"
"Look, Lorax," I said, "there's no cause for alarm. I chopped just one tree. I'm doing no harm. I'm being quite useful. This thing is a thneed. A thneed's a fine something that all people need. It's a shirt. It's a sock. It's a glove. It's a hat. But it has other uses, yes, far beyond that. You can use it for carpets, for pillows, for sheets, for curtains, or covers, for bicycle seats," the Lorax said.
"Sir, you are crazy with greed. There is no one on earth who would buy that fool's need."
But the very next minute, I proved he was wrong. For just at that minute, a chap came along, and he thought that the need I had knitted was great. He happily bought it for $3.98. I laughed at the Lorax. "You poor stupid guy, you never can tell what some people will buy."
"I repeat,"
cried the Lorax,
"I speak for the trees."
"I'm busy," I told him. "Shut up, if you please." I rushed across the room and in no time at all built a radio phone. I put in a quick call. I called on my brothers and uncles and aunts and I said, "Listen here, here's a wonderful chance for the whole Wunsler family to get mighty rich. Get over here fast. Take the road to North Niche. Turn left at Weehawk and sharp right at South Stitch." And in no time at all, in the factory I built, the whole Wunsler family was working full tilt. We were all knitting thneeds, just as busy as bees, to the sound of the chopping of truffula trees. Then, oh, baby, oh, how my business did grow. Now, chopping one tree at a time was too slow, so I quickly invented my super axe hacker, which whacked off 4 truffula trees at one smacker. We were making thneeds 4 times as fast as before, and that Lorax, he didn't show up anymore. But the next week, he knocked on my new office door. He snapped,
"I'm the Lorax who speaks for the trees, which you seem to be chopping as fast as you please. But I'm also in charge of the brown barbaloots who played in the shade in their barbaloot suits and happily lived eating truffula fruits. Now, thanks to your hacking my trees to the ground, there's not enough truffula food to go round, and my poor barbaloots are all getting the crummies, because they have gas and no food in their tummies. They loved living here, but I can't let them stay. They'll have to find food, and I hope that they may. Good luck, boys,"
he cried, and he sent them away. I, the Wunsler, felt sad as I watched them all go. But business is business, and business must grow, regardless of crummies and tummies, you know. I meant no harm, I most truly did not. But I had to grow bigger, so bigger I got. I biggered my factory, I biggered my roads, I biggered my wagons, I biggered the loads of the needs I shipped out. I was shipping them forth, to the south, to the east, to the west, to the north. I went right on biggering, selling more needs, and I biggered my money, which everyone needs. Then again he came back. I was fixing some pipes when that old nuisance Lorax came back with more gripes.
"I am the Lorax,"
he coughed and he whiffed, he sneezed and he snuffled, he snarled, he sniffed.
"Wunsler,"
he cried with a cruffulous croak.
"Wunsler, you're making such smogulous smoke. My poor swanny swans, why, they can't sing a note. Oh, no one can sing who has smog in his throat. And so,"
said the Lorax,
"please pardon my cough. They cannot live here, so I'm sending them off. Where will they go? I don't hopefully know. They may have to fly for a month or a year to escape from the smog you've smogged up round here. Once more,
snapped the Lorax. His dander was up.
Let me say a few words about gluppity-glup. Your machinery chugs on day and night without stop, making gluppity-glup, also shloppity-slop. And what do you do with this leftover goo? I'll show you, you dirty old once-for-a-man, you. You're glumping the pond where the humming fish hummed. No more can they hum, for their gills are all gummed. So, I'm sending them off. Oh, their future is dreary. They'll walk on their fins and get woefully weary in search of some water that isn't so smeary.
And then I got mad. I got terribly mad. I yelled at Lorax, "Now listen here, Dad. All you do is yap, yap and say bad, 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 bad. Well, I have my rights, sir, and I'm telling you I intend to go on doing just what I do. And for your information, you Lorax, I'm figuring on biggering and biggering and biggering and biggering, turning more trufflet trees into needs, which everyone needs." And at that very moment, he heard a loud whack. From outside in the fields came a sickening smack of an axe on the tree. Then we heard the tree fall. The very last truffula tree of them all. No more trees, no more thneeds, no more work to be done. So in no time, my uncles and aunts, every one, all waved me goodbye. They jumped into my cars and drove away under the smoke-smuggered stars. Now all that was left neath the bad-smelling sky was my big empty factory, the Lorax, and I. The Lorax said nothing, just gave me a glance, just gave me a very sad, sad backward glance as he lifted himself by the seat of his pants. And I'll never forget the grim look on his face when he heisted himself and took leave of this place through a hole in the smog, without leaving a trace. And all that the Lorax left here in this mess was a small pile of rocks with the one word, unless. Whatever that meant, well, I just couldn't guess. That was long, long ago. But each day since that day, I've sat here and worried away. Through the years while my buildings have fallen apart, I've worried about it with all of my heart. But now, says the Onceler, now that you're here, the word of the Lorax seems perfectly clear. Unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing is going to get better. It's not. So, catch, calls the Onceler. He lets something fall. It's a truffula seed. It's the last one of all. You're in charge of the last of the truffula seeds. And truffula trees are what everyone needs. Plant a new truffula. Treat it with care. Give it clean water and feed it fresh air. Grow a forest. Protect it from axes that hack. Then the Lorax and all of his friends may come back.
Behind Dr. Seuss, maybe our next favorite author, was Mother Goose. There have been numerous attempts to identify her as an individual person, but probably Mother Goose should best be seen not as one person, but as a storyteller. One of my favorite stories was The House That Jack Built.
This is the house that Jack built. This is the malt that lay in the house that Jack built. This is the rat that ate the malt that lay in the house that Jack built. This is the cat that killed the rat that ate the malt that lay in the house that Jack built. This is the dog that worried the cat that killed the rat that ate the malt that lay in the house that Jack built. This is the cow with the crumpled horn that tossed the dog that worried the cat that killed the rat that ate the malt that lay in the house that Jack built. This is the maiden all forlorn that milked the cow with the crumpled horn that tossed the dog that worried the cat that killed the rat that ate the malt that lay in the house that Jack built. This is the man all tattered and torn that kissed the maiden all forlorn, that milked the cow with a crumpled horn, that tossed the dog, that worried the cat, that killed the rat, that ate the malt, that lay in the house that Jack built. This is the priest, all shaven and shorn, that married a man all tattered and torn, that kissed the maiden all forlorn, that milked the cow with a crumpled horn, that tossed the dog, that worried the cat, that killed the rat, that ate the malt, that lay in the house that Jack built. This is the cock that crowed in the morn, that waked the priest all shaven and shorn, that married the man all tattered and torn, that kissed the maiden all forlorn, that milked the cow with a crumpled horn, that tossed the dog, that worried the cat, that killed the rat, that ate the malt, that lay in the house that Jack built. This is the farmer sowing his corn, that kept the cock that crowed in the morn, that waked the priest all shaven and shorn, that married the man all tattered and torn, that kissed the maiden all forlorn, that milked the cow with a crumpled horn, that tossed the dog, that worried the cat, that killed the rat, that ate the malt, that lay in the house that Jack built.
Most children do not read poetry just as poetry. They read, and were read to, poetry in the form of stories. So pretend again, sitting in the chair with a little one in your lap, reading, probably for the umpteenth time, since that's what children wanted, a story. Chell Silverstein was the author of the popular prose story, Lafcadio, the Lion That Shot Back. He was also the author of many poetic stories, such as the one that follows, A Giraffe and a Half. If you had a giraffe and he stretched another half,
you would have a giraffe and a half.
If he put on a hat and inside lived a rat,
you would have a giraffe and a half with a rat in his hat.
If you dressed him in a suit and he looked very cute,
you would have a giraffe and a half with a rat in his hat looking cute in a suit.
If you glued a rose to the tip of his nose,
you would have a giraffe and a half with a rat in his hat looking cute in a suit with a rose on his nose.
If a bumblebee stung him right on the knee,
you would have a giraffe and a half with a rat in his hat looking cute in a suit with a rose on his nose and a bee on his knee.
If he put on a shoe and then stepped in some glue,
you would have a giraffe and a half with a rat in his hat looking cute in a suit with a rose on his nose and a bee on his knee and some glue on his shoe.
If you gave him a flute and he played tootie toot,
you would have a giraffe and a half with a rat in his hat looking cute in a suit with a rose on his nose and a bee on his knee and some glue on a shoe playing toot on a flute.
If he used a chair to comb his hair,
you would have a giraffe and a half with a rat in his hat looking cute in a suit with a rose on his nose and a bee on his knee and some glue on a shoe playing toot on a flute with a chair in his hair.
If he tripped on a snake who was eating some cake,
you would have a giraffe and a half with a rat in his hat looking cute in a suit with a rose on his nose and a bee on his knee and some glue on his shoe playing toot on a flute with a chair in his hair and a snake eating cake.
If he found an old trunk and inside was a skunk,
you would have a giraffe and a half with a rat in his hat looking cute in a suit with a rose on his nose and a bee on his knee and some glue on his shoe playing toot on a flute with a chair in his hair and a snake eating cake and a skunk in a trunk.
If he met a fat dragon who sat in a wagon,
you would have a giraffe and a half with a rat in his hat looking cute in a suit with a rose on his nose and a bee on his knee and some glue on a shoe playing toot on a flute with a chair in his hair and a snake eating cake and a skunk in a trunk and a dragon in a wagon.
If he jumped on a bike and rode over a spike,
you would have a giraffe and a half with a rat in his hat looking cute in a suit with a rose on his nose and a bee on his knee and some glue on his shoe playing toot on a flute with a chair in his hair and a snake eating cake and a skunk in a trunk and a dragon in a wagon and a spike in his bike.
If a blubbery whale got a hold of his tail,
you would have a giraffe and a half with a rat in his hat looking cute in a suit with a rose on his nose and a bee on his knee and some glue on his shoe playing toot on a flute with a chair in his hair and a snake eating cake and a skunk in a trunk and a dragon in a wagon and a spike in his bike and a whale on his tail.
If he fell in a hole that was dug by a mole,
you would have a giraffe and a half with a rat in his hat looking cute in a suit with a rose on his nose and a bee on his knee and some glue on his shoe playing toot on a flute with a chair in his hair and a snake eating cake and a skunk in a trunk and a dragon in a wagon and a spike in his bike and a whale on his tail and a hole with a mole. But if you brought him a pole to climb out of the hole and the whale left his tail and went off for the mail and he gave the spiked bike to a scout on a hike and he left that fat dragon because his wagon was sagging, and he gave his chair to a tired old bear, and he traded his flute to a bird for some fruit, and he told that old snake to go jump in the lake, and a man who bought junk bought the trunk with a skunk. And he gave the rose to a girl he chose, while the bee on his knee flew away with a flea. And he put the shoe with the glue on you, and that silly old rat ran away with his hat. And he put his suit in the laundry chute, and he shrank another half. You would have
a giraffe. Here follows a work by Sandra Boynton. She wrote about what may be the fascination of every child, the belly button book.
This tiny hippopotamus has something small to say, and if we're very quiet now, she'll say it right away. Listen. Bebo. You might not know what Bebo means, or maybe you've forgotten. It's just the tiny hippo way of saying belly button. Bebo. We hippos love our belly bees. They're round and cute and funny, and there's a place we take them when the summer days are sunny. Come. Bebo. Ah, look at all the hippos with a belly button each. Do you wonder where we are? It's Belly Button Beach, where tons of hippos stand around in bathing suits too little because they hope you will admire the button on their middle. We don't do much throughout the day. That's how we like it best. We nibble grapes, we watch the waves, we take a little rest. We always love to get balloons, and I know why. Do you? Because we like to think balloons have belly buttons too. Boon! Soon after dark upon the beach, we sing our favorite song, and if you're feeling in a mood, we hope you'll sing along. Belly, belly button, you're oh so fine. Ooh, belly button, I'm so happy you're mine. We sing this song on summer nights or when it's hot outside, but never in cold winter time when belly buttons hide. No, never in cold winter time when belly buttons hide. Bye-bye, Bebo!
In 1914, a Canadian soldier, Harry Colborne, was aboard a troop train heading for England. When the train made a stop in Ontario, Harry bought a black bear cub from a hunter. He called it Winnie, short for his hometown of Winnipeg, and he took the bear along with them to England as a mascot. When he was sent to France, he loaned the bear to the London Zoo. By the time he returned, the bear had become such a popular exhibit that he decided to leave it there. Sometime later, the exhibit was visited by young Christopher Milne, who brought his own stuffed teddy bear along. He was so enthralled with the bear that he changed the name of his own stuffed toy from Edward to Winnie. It became the inspiration of Christopher's father, A.A. Milne, and his creation, Winnie the Pooh.
Wherever I am, there's always Pooh. There's always Pooh and me. Whatever I do, he wants to do. Where are you going today? Said Pooh. Well, that's very odd, 'cause I was too. Let's go together, says Pooh, says he. Let's go together, says Pooh. What's 11? I said to Pooh. Twice what? Said Pooh to me. I think it ought to be 22. Just what I think myself, said Pooh. It wasn't an easy sum to do, but that's what it is, said Pooh, said he. That's what it is, said Pooh. Let's look for dragons, I said to Pooh. Yes, let's, said Pooh to me. We crossed the river and found a few. Yes, those are dragons, all right, said Pooh. As soon as I saw their beaks, I knew. That's what they are, said Pooh, said he. That's what they are, said Pooh. Let's frighten the dragons, I said to Pooh. That's right, said Pooh to me. I'm not afraid, I said to Pooh. And I held his paw, and I shouted, Shoo, silly old dragons, and off they flew. I wasn't afraid, said Pooh, said he. I'm never afraid with you. So wherever I am, there's always Pooh. There's always Pooh and me. What would I do, I said to Pooh, if it wasn't for you? And Pooh said, true, it isn't as much fun for one, but two can stick together, says Pooh, says he. That's how it is, says Pooh.
And Christopher and Pooh did all kinds of things together, as indicated by this next little piece, simply entitled Friends.
There's lots and lots of people who are always asking things, like dates and pounds and ounces and the names of funny kings. And the answer's either sixpence or 100 inches long. And I know they'll think me silly if I get the answer wrong. So Pooh and I go whispering, and Pooh looks very bright and says, well, I say sixpence, but I don't suppose I'm right.
And then it doesn't matter what the answer ought to be. Because if he's right, I'm right. And if he's wrong, it isn't me.
Even when everything seems to be going well, children will have those moments where they worry about things. Joe Silverstein captured that with this little piece called What If?
Last night, while I lay thinking here, some what-ifs crawled inside my ear and pranced and partied all night long and sang their same old what-if song. What if I'm dumb in school? What if they close the swimming pool? What if I get beat up? What if there's poison in my cup? What if I start to cry? What if I get sick and die? What if I flunk that test? What if green hair grows on my chest? What if nobody likes me? What if a bolt of lightning strikes me? What if I don't grow taller? What if my head starts getting smaller? What if the fish won't bite? What if the wind tears up my kite? What if they start a war? What if my parents get divorced? What if the bus is late? What if my teeth don't grow in straight? What if I tear my pants? What if I never learn to dance? Everything seems swell, and then the nighttime what-ifs strike again.
With most children, the best story of all was the bedtime story. We close with a work written by Anna Dudry, Llama Llama, Red Pajama.
Llama Llama, Red Pajama, reads a story with his mama. Mama kisses baby's hair. Mama Llama goes downstairs. Llama Llama, Red Pajama, feels alone without his mama. Baby Llama wants a drink. Mama's at the kitchen sink. Llama Llama, Red Pajama, calls down to his llama mama. Mama says she'll be up soon. Baby Llama hums a tune. Llama Llama, Red Pajama, waiting for his mama. Mama isn't coming yet. Baby Llama starts to fret. Llama Llama, Red Pajama, whimpers softly for his mama. Mama Llama hears the phone. Baby Llama starts to moan. Llama Llama, Red Pajama, listens quiet for his mama. What is Mama Llama doing? Baby Llama starts boo-hooing. Llama Llama, Red Pajama, hollers loudly for his mama. Baby Llama stomps and pouts. Baby Llama jumps and shouts. Llama Llama, Red Pajama, in the dark without his mama, eyes wide open, covers drawn. What if Mama Llama's gone? Llama Llama, Red Pajama, weeping, wailing for his mama. Will his mama ever come? Mama Llama, run, run, run! Baby Llama, what a tizzy. Sometimes Mama's very busy. Please stop all this llama drama and be patient for your mama. Little Llama, don't you know Mama Llama loves you so? Mama Llama's always near, even if she's not right here. Llama Llama, Red Pajama, gets two kisses from his mama. Snuggles, pillow, soft and deep. Baby Llama goes to sleep.
This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And thank you for listening in to the Poetry Corner of the Bookshelf.
And this is Michael Martin. We have been bringing you some children's poetry, not about children from an adult's remembrances, but poetry about children and to children as children. We hope that you've enjoyed the show. And until next time, goodbye.